Before we go into our interview today, I wanted to let everyone know we have a new sponsor for our Energy Question podcast, the U.S. Oil and Gas Association, or USOGA for short. First established in 1917, USOGA has been an effective and creative voice for the industry for more than a century now. USOGA is dedicated to educating the public, policymakers, and legislators at the federal, state, and local levels about the value of the domestic oil and natural gas industry. If you're in the industry and not currently a USOGA member, please consider joining the association as a way of helping it tell your story to the policymakers whose actions impact everything you do each and every day. You can start that process by contacting USOGA through its website, usoga.org. Thanks so much to USOGA for sponsoring the Energy Question podcast, and now on with our show.
Hello, welcome to the Energy Question with David Blackman. I'm your host, David Blackman, and my special guest today is a friend of the show, Megan Lapp, who's the fisheries liaison for Seafreeze Industries up in the Northeast. How are you?
Pretty good.
It's good to see you again. Thank you for agreeing to come on. It's I guess it's been 4 months since we talked. I think it was in August, and a lot has happened, of course, with the fisheries industry and our friends in Big Wind and all the beached whales. So there's a lot to catch up on. How have you been since August? Is everything going well, I hope, for the fisheries industry up there?
Well, it is getting busy. It's getting busier and busier. More offshore wind projects have been approved by the feds. Revolution Wind has been approved. Empire Wind has been approved. Right. They are continuing construction of two wind farms currently. One of them, Vineyard Wind, the one that we're suing on, that's on our squid fishing grounds. And then also South Fork Wind Farm. They've got a couple turbines up as well off the coast of Rhode Island. So it is plowing ahead.
Well, Vineyard Wind is a ripe topic for discussion. You sent over an article yesterday via email from E&E News trumpeting the fact that Vineyard Wind just hired a new CEO, and the new CEO happens to be a Massachusetts regulator who helped ram through the permits for that project, right? I mean, isn't that kind of a clear conflict of interest?
Well, there has been a pattern of Massachusetts state employees going to work directly for Vineyard Wind. That has been like kind of the MO of that project the whole time. There was a guy named Brendan Moss, who was Governor Charlie Baker's like communications secretary. He went to go become comms for Vineyard Wind. One of Charlie Baker's campaign advisors, I believe his name was Jim Conroy. He advised Charlie Baker's campaign, but then went to become Vineyard Wind's spokesperson to cut the deal for Vineyard Wind with the state of Massachusetts. Now there's another, like you said, another woman who was the head of Massachusetts Clean Energy Center, you know, that kind of paved the way for offshore wind in Massachusetts, who's now the CEO of Vineyard Wind. I mean, it continues. I've seen, you know, wind companies, they buy state employees and they buy federal employees, and they're very strategic on how they do it. One of the wind companies that owns Revolution Wind, South Fork Wind, a whole bunch of projects south of Rhode Island, they purchased the Coast Guard guy who was in charge of the navigational study of their lease area before the study was done. And then the study came out and said, no, there's no radar interference. Everything is fine, except it wasn't fine. But they bought the guy doing, you know, overseeing the study for the feds. So it's not a revolving door. It is a one-way door. You work for the state or the feds, then you go work for offshore wind. That's how this is going.
Yeah, you know, I when I read that story, I got to thinking, of course, I've been in Texas in the oil industry my whole career. And of course, you know, employees from the Texas Railroad Commission frequently end up going to work for the oil and gas industry. There's a lot of geologists and engineers who work at the Railroad Commission. But this is comparable to the chairman of the Railroad Commission going to work for ExxonMobil, basically. And I couldn't think of any instance in which anything like that had actually happened. I just think it's awfully unseemly, and it's surprising to me that, you know, I went out and looked to see if anyone other than E&E News had reported on this, and couldn't really find any of the traditional major news outlets having published stories about it. And of course, when you read the E&E News story, it's like there's, I mean, it's kind of a puff piece. It's just really surprising to me that you would think someone would at least note the clear conflict of interest that represents. It's really kind of wild to me. But of course, it's the wind industry,
right?
And it's a big promotional thing for the Biden administration, and all these state governments have set all these arbitrary goals they want, you know, of how much big wind out offshore they want to build, and it's like they're just kind of willy-nilly going at it to tick off those boxes that they've set for themselves without any real conscientious examination of the negative impacts of all this. I mean, do you feel the same way? Has anything changed?
The only thing that's changed is that the process has been even more accelerated, you know? And I will say, you know, it, like, what I have learned throughout this process, David, is the very real difference on how oil and gas, the process is done for oil and gas versus offshore wind. Obviously, the process for oil and gas is like, you know, more established, right? Like, it's been around for a long time. It's a more established process. So that's fair. But the way that it is done is totally different. Like, offshore oil and gas starts with a big area. It gets whittled down after, you know, conflicts are identified. And, you know, by the time you end up with a lease area, it's pretty much been deconflicted. And then, you know, then you kind of go through that process. And, you know, the documentations for oil and gas, you know, like the way that the government conducts their reviews, it says, well, you know, we're trying to balance environmental protection with domestic energy production, you know, and there's even language in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act that talks about balancing interests for oil and gas, right? So that's kind of how that process goes. Offshore wind is totally different. BOEM cited most of the leases without any prior anything. Like, they just threw leases out there. Right. Like, they collaborated with the states. They were like, well, what are your energy goals? The states were like, well, this is our energy goals and this is what we want. Put it here. And then they just cited all these leases. So you have conflicts. Right. Like, they created conflicts. And even when they were aware of conflicts or made aware of conflicts, they didn't care. They leased them anyway because they were beholden to the states.
Yeah.
The way that they conduct their review is, if you read their documents, they say, well, you know, our purpose and need is to now fulfill Biden's executive order on tackling the climate crisis, to fulfill state legislative renewable power goals, and to fulfill the power purchase agreement that the state has already made with the developer prior to the review. So they limit all of their, you know, review or alternatives that they'll consider to basically full build out of the area, because that's what the developer needs. But what's interesting is that if you actually read the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act with offshore wind as opposed to oil and gas, it's actually more restrictive. And it doesn't say balance these interests. It says the secretary shall ensure a list of things. So, like, with oil and gas, BOEM's got a lot more leeway, but their process also makes a lot more sense. With offshore wind, it makes absolutely no sense. And they're, like, just totally, like, in flagrant violation of the law. So you see, as you mentioned, you know, it's the policy choice. This is what they want. It's full steam ahead, really, regardless of any impacts.
And one of the most impactful things, I think, that's impacted the whale population has been the seismic surveys that you have to do in order to understand the geology beneath the surface of the ocean. And I think it's a key point to point out that the Interior Department, BOEM, and all these regulators apply the precautionary principle that we discussed last time so rigorously where oil and gas is concerned and seismic surveys are concerned, that they haven't even allowed the oil and gas industry to update, to conduct seismic surveys, to update the potential for oil and gas inventory off the Atlantic coast for almost 40 years now. I mean, there's been repeated efforts in Congress to get DOI to allow that to happen, but they're so concerned about the impacts of seismic surveys when it's the oil and gas industry on the whale population and other marine mammals that they won't even allow that inventory to be updated. Yet when it's big wind, when it's the offshore wind industry, there doesn't seem to be any application of the precautionary principle at all that I can see. I assume nothing's changed since August related to that.
No, it hasn't. And, you know, granted, oil and gas seismic is a lot more powerful than offshore wind seismic. But, you know, one of the things that I've been watching and reading is, you know, for most environmental assessments, the government has to conduct a cumulative impacts assessment because, Yes. You know, one action, if it's really in the context of a whole bunch of other actions, the impact is more, right? So they're supposed to do that with, you know, when they review the construction plans, but the government does not conduct cumulative impact assessments when it comes to the surveys. And so there's been a lot of commenters who have said to NOAA, it's NOAA that issues NOAA, those permits. And they've said, well, you guys need to do cumulative impact assessments. And NOAA says, no, we don't consider them related actions. We don't consider the different seismic surveys or the different constructions or whatever related actions. So we do it as a standalone assessment. But when you actually look at the charts that the Coast Guard puts out, there's like multiple seismic surveys happening in the same places at the same time. So it's like they're overlapping. Like that's not standalone. That is for sure cumulative. And that's a problem because, you know, I said it before, you know, unlike the Gulf of Mexico, where really there's like, you know, one baleen whale and it kind of stays in its area off of like Florida. Yeah. The East Coast is a superhighway for multiple large baleen whale migrations that are like a lot, like there's like five of them that are endangered. Yeah. So it's not the same thing. And I'm like, and if you're going to have overlapping surveys in time and space that are seismic testing right where these whales are, that's like a problem and somebody needs to look at it. And you know, it's very interesting now is that NOAA has just come out with a study that its own scientists did. One of the critically endangered whales is the North Atlantic right whale, right? This is what, right. I mean, we have vessel speed restrictions for these things. We're talking about a vessel speed restriction, literally for the whole East Coast. For any boats 35 feet and over, you got to go 10 knots. That's what the government's looking at right now because they get hit, right, by ships and stuff. So right. The seismic surveys deafen them. We already know this. The permits are out there. And that's what it says, temporary deafness for surveys and potentially, you know, up to permanent deafness for construction. But like, you know, that's okay. And then if they get hit by ships, well, you know, they're hit by ships. It wasn't because they were deaf, but whatever. So what they have to do before construction is they have protected species observers on the windmill construction boats. They're supposed to look for whales, right? But obviously, like, they're whales, right? Like, they swim underwater. So right. You're not going to see them all the time. So this new study came out and said, well, protected species observers only see the whales like 20% of the time. Makes sense. So, but then they said, you know, one of the other mitigation measures that the wind companies have to use is called passive acoustic monitoring. So basically they put hydrophones around, right? And they listen. If they hear the whales, then you know that there's one there because you heard it, right?
Yeah.
And that makes sense. So if the protected species observers only see them 20% of the time, well, then that means that, you know, listening for them is pretty important. So they only require currently that the wind developer listen for 1 hour prior to starting pile driving, okay, for the whales. But what they found is that North Atlantic right whales, remember the critically endangered kind that we want to put speed restrictions for up and down the coast, that kind of whale, if you only listen for an hour, you have a 96% chance of not hearing them. So as you increase the number of hours, if you listen to them for 18 hours, you have a 74% chance of hearing one. in the area because they just are not, you know, they're not as vocal as some of the other. So what they're recommending now, this is NOAA, is saying, well, prior to pile driving, you should have to listen for 24 hours because then you'll probably hear, like if there's one in the area, you will hear it.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that gets put into new permits. Because,
well, that would make sense though, right? I mean,
it would make sense if you're going to tell every Tom, Dick, and Harry that like they've got to go 10 miles an hour because maybe you might hit one. Well, then, you know, if you know that what you're doing now has a 96% failure rate, maybe you should change that. So we'll see what happens with that, especially on the political level, because that would slow down construction, obviously, considerably. But it's an Endangered Species Act protected animal. And you know very well, I'm sure, from oil and gas, ESA trumps like everything.
Well, it should. I mean, and it should.
It's
why the law exists.
Right.
And I've always been kind of a social outcast among my peers in the oil industry because I've always been an advocate for the ESA and the rational application of it according to the statute. And so, I mean, it should take precedent. Another thing, you mentioned shipping traffic. And another thing that's happened since August is Ørsted announced the cancellation of those two big projects offshore New Jersey. Have we seen a reduction in ship traffic as a result of those cancellations, or were they not in the process of developing yet?
They were not in the process of developing it yet. They hadn't gone to construction yet. They are still actively surveying the export cable route for those projects, which is interesting. I've heard, you know, speculation that other projects may want to use that same cable route. So the surveys are continuing. So, you know, we'll have to see what happens there. But, you know, it's going to be interesting, David, to kind of even see what happens later on this year with some of the earnings calls of these companies, because now that project was canceled. There's two others that Ørsted has said are not financially viable at this time. They're trying to beg the administration for more money for those projects.
Of course.
You know, and we'll kind of have to see how all of that plays out. But, you know, cumulatively on the East Coast, this is another big, you know, as far as whale strikes, right? Like if you want to make 35-foot boats go 10 knots, right, then ship strikes must be fairly important, right? When you look at the cumulative number of vessels, if all these projects pretend they go ahead, pretend they get the money that they need from the feds or the states or whatever, and pretend they go ahead, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds of more boats.
Yeah.
At the same time, in the migration corridor of these animals, at the same time, and the cumulative impact of that, like 100% needs to be assessed, because you're not talking about, you know, like one project happening on its own. It's right. You're on the migration corridor and you have all these projects going and you got hundreds of boats going all around. You know, that's for sure a cumulative impact.
Well, it's such an insane thing to me because I mean, there's no real reason, no compelling reason whatsoever for offshore wind to even exist as an industry. There are far more preferable, more efficient, cheaper alternatives to providing that electricity than offshore wind. And it's like there's this, it's almost like it's become a religious exercise for these governors and state officials. And of course, this administration is eaten up with it to just genuflect about offshore wind. And it's just clearly, so clearly nothing but a virtue signaling exercise for these politicians. I mean, do you have any hope that any of these state officials might wake up at some point and say, hey, maybe we ought to go in a different direction?
Well, most of the states in the Northeast, like you said, are just hell-bent on doing this. There is not a logical connection. Because like you said, like they don't work. Like there's that part, right? Like they don't work. And I remember specifically talking to members of NYSERDA, which is New York State Research and Energy Development Authority. And early on, you know, years back when they first started, you know, citing their offshore wind projects. And I remember they said to me, oh, you know, we want to talk to you. And I said, you know, especially the project at that time that they were citing was, again, right on one of our major fishing grounds. And, you know, we gave them data, we fought it, and they said, nah, we're going to lease it anyway. You know, don't worry, we'll deconflict later. And of course they haven't.
Right,
and now it just got approved. But, you know, I told them, I said, look, I was like, I'm originally from Long Island. I'm like, Long Island, which was once a very, very beautiful natural space, is now basically one giant strip mall. I said, you don't need to do offshore wind. You have more building space, more roof space than you could ever want. If you want to do like renewables, you've already taken this environment and basically destroyed it. Put solar panels on all these buildings, right? And run it out to the street where you have like phone poles with actual transformers on them. There you go. And their answer to me was, that's not what the governor wants to do. The governor just wants to do offshore wind. And I was like, well, then I think our conversation's over. Because like you said, you know, destroying millions and millions of acres of pristine ocean for something that like doesn't work, endangers species, you know, threatens domestic food production and national defense and all kinds of a host of other things, it's inappropriate. Don't do it. You know what I mean? Like, well, name me one other power plant that takes that much space.
Exactly. I mean, would they ever allow an oil and gas drilling operation in the middle of the most prolific whale migration and breeding corridor in North America? I mean, it's almost as if when you look at the leases they offered in the Gulf of Mexico for wind over the summer that sale that completely failed. If you look at it and overlay the map of migratory bird corridors for hundreds and hundreds of species of migratory birds, those leases were literally smack dab in the middle of that migration corridor. It's almost like they seek out these areas that will be most negatively impactful to endangered species. It almost seems to be a conscious exercise on their part. And I find that unexplainable. From a logical standpoint, I mean, I don't expect you to necessarily answer that, but it's mind-boggling to me, the whole thing.
Yep. And you know, the problem for this anyway, for offshore wind, was that they never looked at any data before. They just kind of like cited them,
right?
And then it's like, well, we'll deconflict at the end, but at the end they can't deconflict because they say that they need to meet the power purchase agreements of the state and the developer,
exactly,
which means full build out. So they can never at any point in their process that they have made up, like actually comply with the law. And, you know, something that I look at, you know, especially in this, in the Northeast region, you know, which is heavily built up, obviously it's very densely populated region and things like that. And, you know, I even look at pictures from when I was a kid and I look at places that now are no longer woods, are no longer this, are no longer that. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that once you develop something, you never get it back. So development needs to be thoughtful and development needs to be, you know, deliberately taking into account the impacts of that development. You know, and I always liken the offshore wind issue to back in the 50s and the 60s on the East Coast. They filled in the salt marshes with like garbage and fill. Right. And then they bulkheaded it and they built on it. And, you know, people at that time, if anybody said, hey, don't do that, don't do that, that's like, you're going to create a natural disaster. You know, they were told, well, you're standing in the way of progress. You know, now today, I can tell you that 100% the commercial fishing industry still deals with the impacts of that because they filled in nursery habitat for food, for fish. Right. And we still deal in management with the implications of that. Those areas are never going back to salt marshes. Now it's, you know what I mean? It's done. It's over. Yeah. You have now lost it. And then, you know, when storms come, when hurricanes come, guess what? Well, you filled in the sponge. That was a sponge that absorbs storm surge. So now you're going to get flooded. And now everybody wants their houses to be insured because they built on a salt marsh. And you know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, it's, and that was a major ecological disaster for the East Coast, and you'll never get it back. And I tell people, like, the offshore wind issue is scales of magnitude larger, and you will never get it back.
Yeah.
And you know, that's irresponsible. That's just not, it's not okay. When you look at the footprint of this, and it's like, well, what's the square footage of a gas plant? What's the square footage of a nuclear facility?
A nuclear facility, yeah.
You know,
which,
like,
which,
and then look
two
at the
nuclear
footprint
facilities
of this.
Would generate far more electricity than everything that's planned for the Northeast offshore wind. Far
right.
more.
Right.
With zero
right.
emissions.
With zero emissions. And, you know, everybody, even if you look at BOEM's documents, they're like, well, you know, maybe it'll, most of the time they're like, this isn't going to impact climate change. It's going to have no measurable impact on climate change to build these things, right? Which is true. And then they'll say, but we maybe expect a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions when fossil fuel plants are retired. But I'm like, the wind only produces electricity about 40% of the time. So 60% of the time, you still have to have the fossil fuel plant. So you're not retiring them. Hello. Like,
well, you
and you have to keep
them
on all the time, yeah, because you don't know when the wind is going to die down or not.
Right.
It's not predictable. You know?
Oh, that's right. You mentioned the lawsuit litigation against Vineyard Wind. Talk about that. Tell our viewers what that's about. What are the grounds?
Sure. So Vineyard Wind was sited on a major squid fishing ground.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of ecological problems with that. We're not going to be able to operate our boats and gear in there. And like I said earlier, you know, the law says they have to provide for safety, which they didn't, the protection of the environment, which they didn't, the prevention of interference with reasonable uses of the ocean, which is us, they didn't. And a host of other issues. It's cited on right whale area. There's, you know, there's Endangered Species Act issues, Marine Mammal Protection Act issues, there's Clean Water Act issues, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And the analysis, even in some of their analysis, they were like, yeah, well, the squid fishery won't be able to operate in there. And the impacts of fishing are major. The impacts to navigation are major. Whoopsie, we're going to go ahead and do it anyway, right? So we actually have partnered with the Texas Public Policy Foundation, who's taking our case for free. Because again, you know, we're the fishing industry, we're small businesses. We don't have that type of, you know, we don't have pockets that deep to go all the way right to the Supreme Court, which is where this is going to go.
Yeah.
Because it's never been litigated before. It's a new use. It's never, you know, the law's never been litigated. So anyways, we're suing on that. We had our hearing
in federal district court,
federal okay district in Massachusetts. Originally, we had filed in the D.C. district, and the government moved us up to the first district in Boston. So we've been up there. We lost our motion for summary judgment. You know, I won't comment on all the details, but let's just say, I think we have a lot of grounds to appeal that decision.
Sure, sounds like it, yeah.
And we are in the process of appealing. So,
well, TPPF is a great group to be partnered with on this. They do fantastic work.
They really do. They really do. They've been absolutely fantastic to work with. And if anybody Googles, if you go on YouTube and you look up a heavy wind trailer or the heavy wind video that they did, they came up to New England and they, you know, there's us on the lawsuit, Seafreeze. There are some commercial fishermen who get a tremendous amount of their income from that area. There are a couple other fishing associations. And, you know, on those videos, I think they really captured, like, some of the plaintiffs, they're like, they've been literally fishing that area for 100 years, multiple generations. And like,
wow,
they have generations coming up underneath them. And that could just all be lost to a foreign offshore wind company because, you know, the policies of the government would prefer to benefit Denmark than the United States. And
well, of course. Of course. Yeah, that sounds like the Biden administration. We're running out of time. We will put links to all that in the show notes when we publish this here in a week or two. Tell everybody where they can go to keep up with the lawsuit and other activity that you're engaged in before we go.
Well, you can always check on TPPF's website. You know what I mean? They've got materials on there. You can also go to the Responsible Offshore Development Alliance, ROTA, rotafisheries.org. They're another fisheries organization that is also suing on that project, and they have a tremendous amount of, you know, materials and information on their website. And as far as, you know, information in general on offshore wind, there's the County of Cape May, New Jersey, who's suing on the project off of New Jersey. They've got a ton of information. There's a group in Rhode Island called Green Oceans that also has compiled a tremendous amount of information if folks want a rabbit trail.
Fantastic. I'm going to have to go do that research myself here. I'm getting excited about doing some more writing about this. So I appreciate the catch up here, and we'll do it again in a few months. And wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, David. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and thanks to our extraordinary producer, Eric Perel, to the Sandstone Group for hosting our podcast, to the U.S. Oil and Gas Association for being our sponsor. I'm David Blackman. That's all for now.